Okay, it's my pleasure to be I'll introduce the topic and then introduce my colleague and then say a sentence or two about myself or who the presenters are. Welcome to the topic, Whatever Happened to Depth Psychology. There was a little bit of confusion over Shabbos. People had asked me what depth psychology is, and perhaps we're being a little too fancy. The depth psychology in this context is the idea of looking at underlying causes when we work with our clients, thinking about early relationships in our clients' life, helping them understand, going on a journey with them that is focused not just on today but on the past as well. The power of early relationships and how it impacts on later relationships and later circumstances, early family dynamics, early trauma, as a way. So when we say the word depth, we're talking about going deeper into the history, into the past of the clients that we're working with. We live in a time where the pressures compel therapists and clients alike, whether it's insurance pressures or others, or time pressures, to create an environment of a quick fix, of the idea of let's do this as quickly as possible. Sometimes parents encourage us to do that. Well, certainly insurance companies encourage us to do that. So Dr. Sorotkin is a dear friend of mine, a colleague that I have great admiration for. If you ever have a chance, he has a website. He's a prolific writer on many, 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 many topics. And it's an honor to be a co-presenter with him. Dr. Sorotkin will present on the research findings. I will talk about some case material in terms of the power of a deeper understanding of the underlying causes that can lead to a sense of healing. Let me just say a word or two about Dr. Sorotkin. He's in private practice in Brooklyn, treating perfectionism, anxiety, OCD, psychogenic disorders, depression, and homosexuality. Has written numerous articles. He also received smicha from Yeshiva Neir Yisrael, a doctorate in clinical psychology from Yeshiva University. He worked for 7 years in Israel for youth Aliyah and as a psychologist in the Israel Defense Forces as part of his reserve duty. It's my pleasure to present Dr. Sorotkin. He will go first. Questions will be reserved for the end. There are CEU forms on the table. One is the green pile for psychologists and the beige pile for social workers.
The color is white. Green psychologist, but for some reason.
So, and then just a little bit about myself so we don't have to deal with introductions. I'm in private practice in Chicago. I have smicha from Lakewood and a PsyD from the Illinois School of Professional Psychology. And I've written here and there on parenting and psychology and Jewish philosophy and speak on the topic as well. It's my great pleasure to introduce Dr. Ben-Zion Sorotkin.
Thank you. Okay, so as Jerry said, if we can hold the questions till... Now this is a question to clarify what I said. First of all, I'd like to thank Jerry for coming up with this idea of us presenting together. Although Jerry lives in Chicago and I live in Brooklyn, I feel like ever since the first time I heard Jerry speak in Nefesh many years ago, I felt like he's a soulmate in our approaches to doing therapy, our understanding of psychology, and I was really very excited from the first time I heard Jerry speak and reading his articles in various magazines, Jewish Action, Jewish Observer. I've always been tremendously impressed and inspired from his integrity, from his warmth, and his commitment to as a therapist. I was really excited when Jerry called me a few months ago and said, hey, how about presenting together in Nefesh on this topic? So I'm really, really pleased to do this. What we're presenting today is a critique of current practices in psychotherapy. I want to make it very clear that it's a critique of practices, not of practitioners. Many of the practitioners who practice in the manner that I'll be critiquing are very dear friends and very respected colleagues who have helped countless patients. So I hope this will be perceived as a machlokes l'shem shemayim as it is intended to be. What is it that the average, the great majority of members of our community, it's true of the community at large also, but we're focusing on our community, What is it they hear when they go to a practitioner, to any mental health practitioner? What is it they hear regarding what the causes of their emotional distress is? I would venture to say that today's zeitgeist, the mindset of today's of most of the practitioners today, what their patients are hearing from the therapist or for the potential patient is that their emotional disorders are caused by genetic malfunctions, chemical imbalances, and various other brain disorders. I want to emphasize, I am not saying that they are told, because if they were told that there are genetic issues that may play some role in making them more vulnerable to various environmental distresses, or if they were told that there are some chemical imbalances that are associated with the disorders, I wouldn't be up here speaking today. Unfortunately, that is not what they are told. They are told, as I'll bring evidence soon, they are told that their problem is caused by chemical imbalance, that their problem is caused by a genetic malfunction. It hurts me deeply to see our profession moving away from a decades-long proud tradition of giving meaning to behavior. And unfortunately, many therapists have become technicians fixing broken machines. There's one example of many. Of many, many examples, really it was the straw that broke the camel's back for me and inspired me to write the article that I wrote and to speak on this topic. A long-time patient who I've seen for many years, who grew up feeling terribly rejected, so that even years later now, as a middle-aged man, he struggles mightily, in spite of years of therapy and medication, he's struggling mightily with feelings of rejection, of social isolation. The way he describes himself, I must have heard this expression from him a million times when he talks about himself in a social setting. He says, "I'm a pariah." That's how he describes himself. This young man, he married a lady who herself struggled tremendously with rejection. So her parents, because of their emotional disorders, were unable to raise her, and she spent most of her childhood growing up in the home of relatives. So they got married and she also suffers from OCD, from quite a severe case of OCD, but she refuses treatment. So because of all these factors, as you can imagine, there's a great deal of stress in their marriage. Their four young boys have been very often witness to verbal altercations between the couple, and the husband reports that he very often has to step in and prevent his wife from being verbally abusive with the children because of her need for excessive control. So when their oldest child got into first grade, the teacher noticed that he's extremely isolated, is unable to interact with other kids, and that he has some certain strange behaviors. So she referred them to a well-known child therapist in our community. Since the father told me about this, I very much encourage him to follow up on this and to go to the therapist. But those two pieces of information that I knew. First of all, I knew that he is very reticent to talk about his emotional problems to other people. It took him many years to open up to me. And I also know that many therapists very quickly jump to the conclusion that problems are genetic. So I very much encourage him to be very open. See, I was down the cusp, so the reason why the therapists do this is because they simply don't get the history. So I encourage them to give the history, to make sure you tell them everything about your emotional problems, your wife's emotional problems, and your shared problems and your marital conflict. And he did that. Nonetheless, the therapist, after speaking to the parents, told the parents that their child is suffering from ADD and from separation anxiety and one or two other things, told him that it's genetic, biological, and referred him to psychiatrist for medication, and behavioral therapy to control the symptoms. The father felt that they weren't really relating to all this child's problems. He asked for a second opinion, went to another well-known child therapist who simply confirmed what the first one said. So the father this time was a little bit more assertive, and he tells the therapist, "Isn't it very likely, considering my history, my years of rejection, my troubles, my social problems, my wife's problems, her OCD, the problems how it infects our marriage and our conflict, and how it affects, you know, my wife's over-control of the children, isn't it very likely that that has something to do with my child's emotional, in some way affect his emotional development?" So the therapist quickly jumped in and reassured the parents that they don't need to feel guilty because it has nothing to do with them. The father later told me that after all the years of therapy that he's been in, he has no problem dealing with guilt. What he's really concerned about is how that his child should get the most effective treatment. So he asked me if I could try to find him a referral to somebody who would deal with it. I must tell you, it was extremely distressing and depressing to discover how difficult it was to find a therapist who would do this. Now, I don't know every single therapist, I'm sure I may have missed some, but most of the therapists that I either asked about or found out, even those with dynamic training, seem to follow the path of the two therapists that they saw. Now, what I find it especially distressing is that these therapists, these very respected therapists, seem to be ignoring vast areas of research. For example, in the last decade or so, there's an unbelievable amount of research on attachment disorder. And the research on attachment disorders has very much confirmed many of the hypotheses of dynamic psychotherapy that for years were difficult to prove because it was very difficult to research. So for example, in a very recent issue of the Journal of Research and Personality, which is clearly not a psychodynamic journal, right? And they said that the contemporary empirical research regarding attachment disorders has led to a renaissance of psychodynamic theory in the research-oriented non-psychoanalytical community. Now, especially this couple, now this child, we say, was suffering from ADD and separation anxiety. There's a tremendous amount of research. In fact, about a year ago, there was a beautiful article in Psychotherapy pleading with clinicians, before you diagnose a child with ADD, make sure he's not suffering from attachment disorders, because the symptoms are almost identical. And the same thing with separation anxiety. There's a ton of research about that. Now, this couple and their child are the poster children for attachment disorder. I mean, look how attachment disorder, you can find more attachment disorders. The history of this couple and their relationship with their child. So, you know, in Gemara, you never say a basic shot if you have a puncher shot, right? There's a simple explanation. It's an attachment disorder. I think all the researchers bear this out. So we speculate about chemical imbalances and genetic disorders that we don't actually see. I don't understand why they're doing this. I remember when I took my first course in science in high school, I remember the first one, the few things I remember. The one first rule they taught us is you give the most parsimonious explanation for observed phenomena. Same idea, you don't give a Deutsch shot if there's Plushev shot. And I think here the Plushev shot is an attachment disorder. So now what is it that patients are commonly told? Patients are told, and I think this is a fact, if you speak to anybody who's gone to a therapist, I think this is what they're commonly told. They're told that early life experiences and environmental pressures play no role in the development of disorder. They are told that these biological formulations have been irrefutably confirmed through brain imaging techniques, twin studies, and other strict scientific methods. They are also told that the best treatment for these disorders are medication, the number one, and some short-term cognitive behavior therapy, 16 sessions will cure practically anything. Right? The perception of most people about the science behind cognitive behavior therapy, most people believe that science has obviated the need for an in-depth understanding of what the history was, what the causes of the problem was. They believe that the science has supposedly proven that all you have to do is focus on the here and now, and that's good enough. Patients are often told that the fact that medications do alleviate many of the symptoms, it is therefore, that is irrefutable evidence that the original cause of the problem was a chemical imbalance. They are told that searching for the cause of the emotional disorder in a person's early development is a waste of time and perhaps even harmful. They are often led to believe that therapists who still practice long-term psychodynamic therapy are old-fashioned, parent-bashing, Freudian analysts, out of touch with current research, pretty much like someone who believes that the Earth is flat. Well, I'm proud to say that I'm a flat earther. Now, if you think I'm exaggerating a little bit, let me tell you that Drew Weston, who's a very famous researcher from Emory University, does research on the effectiveness of psychotherapy. He relates an incident that happened with a colleague of his who was taking the national licensing exam in psychology, where they ask you, you know, what is the correct treatment, quote-unquote, for various disorders such as depression. And when he indicated that his approach is not cognitive behavior therapy, the examiner asked him why he's still practicing an outmoded form of treatment. Now let's talk about what happens. What do people read, when they read books that are written for members of our community, and again, it's true of the community of the large, but we're focusing on our community. What is it that they hear? What are they told? So one of the most popular books written by a mental health clinician from our community, for members of our community, what, again, it's not the name of the author and the name of the book is totally irrelevant because I want to, you know, talk about practices. It says the following in this very popular book, and I quote, "The fact that psychiatric medication, even without psychological therapy, is often effective supports the theory that many types of psychiatric disorders are due to some physiological imbalance of the body chemistry rather than to psychological causes." Again, it's a black and white. It's rather than. It's chemical, it's not psychological. Also, it says in the book, "There is reason to believe that anxiety may occur for purely physiological reasons, perhaps because of genetic factors. In such cases, searching for the reason, quote-unquote, the person is anxious, is inappropriate and may be counterproductive." This is what members of our community are hearing. Now, the purpose of this presentation is to refute those statements with research evidence. I'm purposely avoiding quoting anything from any psycholytical journal. Everything I'm citing is from research-oriented empirical journals. I want to show that it is those dynamic therapists who are practicing in a manner that's more congruent with the research evidence. So let's talk about genetic causes for emotional disorders. The evidence for genetic causes for emotional disorders is much less clear-cut than the way it is commonly presented. If you read the original research reports written by the people who've actually done the research, not the secondary research, and certainly not the stuff that's put out by the pharmaceutical companies. That's probably also if you read about the courses, right? Because it's unbelievably slanted distortions. You know, then the latest, most of the journals, most prestigious journals, have a new rule that they won't print the stuff that's put out by people who work for the pharmaceutical company unless they tell them about what they're planning to study before they start the study. Because what they commonly do, if it comes out against the medication, they simply don't print it. They don't allow them to do that anymore. Better late than never. But if you read the original research, they will tell you, they emphasize that the evidence that points to a possible genetic influence also highlights the much greater environmental influences. If you read the literature, they'll tell you that they found some genes, or usually a group of genes that may have some impact. But they always clearly say that the very same evidence shows that the environment, all the twin studies show that the environmental factors are much greater than the genetic, possible genetic one. In a very recent issue of the American Journal of Psychiatry in 2005, Dr. Pendler wrote a very powerful piece challenging simplistic conceptions of the relationship between genes and psychiatric disorder, what he calls gene talk, which is very popular today, he says, in the lay and professional writing. You can open up the newspaper any day, you can look in the journals. They discovered a gene for alcoholism, violence, homosexuality, depression, the list is endless. Kendler says the following, and I quote, two sentences. "The strong, clear, and direct causal relationship implied by the concept of a gene for does not exist for psychiatric disorder. Although we may wish it to be true, we do not have and are not likely to ever discover genes for psychiatric disorders. Twin and adoption studies suggest that the impact of aggregate genes for major depression are altered by exposure to stressful life events, and for schizophrenia and conduct disorder by exposure to a dysfunctional rearing environment." Now, it's very interesting. Pendler points out a very curious feature of gene talk. He says that we're very comfortable saying that A is the gene for B. We're very uncomfortable saying that Y is an environment for Z. Right? So he says that even though that, for instance, he says, there's a large body of empirical work that supports the hypothesis that severe life events, such as being maltreated as a child, is an important environmental risk factor for conduct disorder. And he says the magnitude for this association is far greater than that observed for any of the genetic connection. Yet we're not comfortable saying that abuse is an environment for conduct disorder. Have you heard anybody saying it recently? Well, I have actually said, and I got into a lot of trouble for it. When I've written, in fact, you could have written a recent issue of the Nefesh News, and you'd see that somebody claimed that my statement that the vast majority of, or the majority of children with conduct disorders, for instance, kids who go off to Derek, that it's caused by being now treated as a child in some way. And I was told that I was being very simplistic, overly simplistic. Somehow nobody thinks if you say you found a gene for the same thing, that nobody says that's considered simplistic, or you found a chemical imbalance, even though the evidence for the prior is much larger than for the latter. Or another, just if in the lake, you can see in the lake community, I'm sure maybe some of you have had this experience. This just happened a few months ago. I get a call from somebody that I know vaguely. Says, listen, I want to ask your opinion. I need a favor. Somebody read a shidduch for my daughter. It was a young man. We heard wonderful things about him. But the Rav from out of town who read the shidduch was very open with us and told us that the mother suffered for years from depression. She was hospitalized many times. She was on medication and so on and so forth. So what do you think he wants to know from me? What's the question? Why? What's the question? Is it genetic? Nobody even, I never in my life, I've been asked this, I have been asked at least 1,000 times these type of questions, not once. I mean this literally. Nobody has ever asked me what effect it might have on a boy that he didn't have a mother who was emotional. I'm telling you, I never had such a question. I've been asked millions of times, you get those type of questions? That's right. That's how it is. I've always been asked this genetic, the only question they ever asked me. And I think, unfortunately, a lot of this stuff they hear from therapists.
Well, because they're trying to assuage the guilt of the family and
quote, you're not. Well, that's what I said in the beginning of that case that I'm dealing with, where the therapist thought they were helping the patient not have to deal with guilt when he just wanted the best treatment for his child. Okay, now as far as chemical, but let's go to chemical imbalances. Now again, I'm not talking about chemical imbalances that are associated with emotional disorder. I'm talking about chemical imbalances as a cause for emotional disorders. I'd like to thank Dr. Yaakov Rosenthal, who I don't know, but he's a Nefesh member who recently made Aliyah, and he had on the Nefesh listserv quotes from a whole host of experts in this area, all challenging this idea of chemical causes, chemical imbalance as a cause for emotional disorder. I'm simply amazed how this construct persists among both lay and professional public in spite of the overwhelming evidence that it simply isn't true. And I'll give you just two quotes from two psychiatrists. One's from Dr. Stephen Stahl, from his book Essential Psychopharmacology from the Cambridge University Press in the year 2000, and he says the following. No single reproducible abnormality in any neurotransmitter or in any of its enzymes or receptors have been shown to cause any common psychiatric disorder. Now from Dr. Joseph Glenn-Muller from the Harvard Medical School, and I quote, hypothetical biochemical imbalances have been presented to the public as established fact. In every instance where such an imbalance was thought to have been found, it was later proven false. I don't know how much clearer than that you can get. I conclude that, I'm not concluding this on my presentation, I'm concluding this sentence. I want to get anybody's hopes up. It's therefore misleading to tell patients that their symptoms are caused by chemical imbalances. It simply isn't true. It is also a tremendous disservice, both in regard to treatment and regard to prevention. A young lady who I've been seeing, who came for her own issues, and she told me something very interesting just last week. She told me she has a brother who's diagnosed with schizophrenia, and she has a brother who went off the derech. And she told me she always lived in terror, because she was told, the family was told, that her brother's schizophrenia is genetic, and the boy going off the derech is something that can happen to anybody for no particular reason. So she was always terrified that she'll be schizophrenic and her children will go off the derech. Now that she knows exactly why these things happen, she is much calmer. I very much identify with David Barlow's comments. I'm sure many of you know he's one of the foremost experts on anxiety disorders. He's written probably the textbook on it. So his latest edition, 2002, he deplores assumptions deeply held by clinicians when facts that have been available for years simply do not support these assumptions. It reminds me when I was first starting out quite a few years ago. You know, today everybody knows that ADD supposedly is caused by genetic chemical causes. But you know what? What is ADD? What did everybody believe ADD was caused by? Some people are over 20 here, right? Sugar, of course. Everybody knew they do. Well, yeah, sugar and nitrites, and then you went on the Feingold diet. That was the cure. You went on the Feingold diet, right? It was this belief persisted among professionals for 20 years after it was totally discredited. I remember when I was still in school, I think, in the clinical psychology review, had a review of the reviews. I think, except Feingold's own study, nobody was able to find it. I read, I think, a list of 25 reviews and totally discredited, and belief went on for years afterwards. And they were always like, you know, and when the kid got, I worked in a school that would disturb kids. There was one kid who the grandmother was raising him, swore that the problem was she didn't let him have any sugar. And he, when he got better, due to our treatment, we had very good therapists, and when he got better, then the grandmother said, because she keeps him off sugar. She didn't know that during lunchtime, he went to the hostess store down the block and piled up with sugar. So she was convinced. If you look at what is written by serious researchers of chemical imbalances and other disorders of the brain, they always point out that these imbalances are more likely to be the result of emotional disorders than the cause. So, for example, in a very lengthy review article recently published in the Bulletin of the Menninger Clinic in 2005, I actually read through the whole thing, Seidel cites compelling empirical evidence that seriously challenges the concept of biologically based mental illnesses. That word is bandied about all over the place. Even insurance companies, you know, recognize this idea, commonly known as BBMIs. Now, people who have actually researched this stuff, such as Seidel, he writes the following. The construct of biological-based mental illness presumes that a biological process is a foundation of mental disorders. Current research does not support this view. Now, you should take from what I'm saying that I don't think that taking medication is ever a good idea. I have a close working relationship with a few psychiatrists, and I don't hesitate to refer a patient for, you know, for medication if it's clinically indicated. Now, the fact the medication can alleviate symptoms, unlike what was written when I quoted before from this book, the fact the medication can alleviate symptoms tells us absolutely nothing about the original cause. A recent article in the Behavioral and Brain Sciences says the following, and again, this is not a psychological journal, as you can hear from the title, says the following: no serious scientist today would assert that the success of any therapeutic method constitute proof of the correctness of the theory on which the therapeutic technique was based. But from a more practical standpoint, I have a friend who's a tax accountant. You probably won't be surprised to hear that every April 15th, he has a splitting headache. And if it takes Tylenol, it alleviates the headache. Does anybody venture to say that the original cause of the problem is some mysterious depletion of Tylenol in his brain? I don't think so. Okay, now let's talk about schizophrenia. Yeah, sure, your clarification, yeah. Yeah. Right, that isn't the original cause. There are chemical imbalances that are associated because it's a circular relationship, right? Which all the evidence points to it. Yeah, I told him it's absolutely not true. Yes, yes. So the evidence all points at. Yeah, associated. Yes, it is probably. Maybe genetic thing may predispose, but the environmental factor is greater.
But it's appropriate to take Tylenol if you have the headache.
Yeah, yeah.
And it is appropriate. So it's not an inappropriate thing to take the medication. What's inappropriate is to say that's what this is about.
But the person also very often resistant to the idea of medication.
Yeah.
I tell
my patients there's no mitzvah to suffer. And if you're working on your problem, you're working on the underlying causes, and now you're suffering. There's patients who I really work very hard to get them to take medication because why suffer for no reason if they can be alleviated, there's no point. I usually prefer, unless it's very urgent, to wait a while till the therapy starts so they shouldn't lose their motivation for therapy, that they should see it as an adjunct, not as a substitute for. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, sure. That's true. In fact, there's a tremendous amount of evidence that therapy alone causes the same brain jam as the brain changes as medication. Of course, it's bidirectional. That's what Seidel writes in his. I cut out that piece just for a shortage of time. He talks about being bidirectional. I think it's on the handout. Okay, now let's talk about schizophrenia. I'm sure there might be some people here who think I'm going a little bit off the deep end questioning the biological basis of schizophrenia. You know, it's one thing to believe that Earth is flat, but to think it doesn't exist is a little bit psychotic. Okay? But nonetheless, let's see what the evidence actually states. The most comprehensive recent research establishes that even schizophrenia is predominantly caused by early unrecognized trauma. I want to again thank Dr. Yaakov Rosenthal, who on the Netflix listserv reported the following. He reported an earth-shattering review of schizophrenia research in the most recent edition of a prestigious Scandinavian psychiatric journal, I won't try pronouncing the name, that provides evidence that between 2/3 to 97% of the individuals suffering from schizophrenia suffered childhood physical or sexual trauma. Yes. He didn't say that. No. I'm not saying that at all, no. Because obviously there are people who experience these same experiences and don't become schizophrenic. No. I said in the beginning that my whole speech is refuting people who claim that it's purely chemical and purely biological. Anybody who says that it's associated or predisposed, I have no problem with that. That reminds me that they often ask Rush Limbaugh, why doesn't he have liberals on his show for equal time? The always answer is, I'm the equal time. The media is predominantly liberal, so he's the equal time. He doesn't have to provide equal time. So I'm the equal time for the biological perspective. Okay? Now, the authors of this study, of this review, John Reed et al., 2005, they cite many studies that point to a significant overlap between the diagnostic construct of schizophrenia and post-traumatic stress disorder. Now, of course, since most contemporary clinicians are biased in their perception of schizophrenia as a biological disorder, they simply don't ask the questions that would uncover the history of abuse. Now, this bias has serious clinical implications because the patients do not get the psychotherapy that they should be getting. The authors also report on a large multi-center study that found that psychological approaches are more effective than medication for psychotic people who suffer childhood trauma. But again, you have to ask the questions that uncover the trauma. Now listen to this last sentence from their study. I think it's a very important line. For some of these psychotic patients, simply making a connection between their life history and their previously incomprehensible symptoms may have a significant therapeutic effect. This is what therapy used to be all about, making sense of the symptoms. Richard Joel, in his presentation, said this one line, I thought it was very useful. Kids want a life that makes sense. And our patients are the same. They want to understand themselves. They want to make sense of what's going on in their life. So one of the other presenters said, I don't remember who it was, he said, the essence of trauma is not seeing the connection between trauma and current issues, and a past issue. Now, this study was widely reported in the lay press. This is one from John Reed. The Guardian of London reported, the psychiatric establishment is about to experience an earthquake that will shake its intellectual foundation. So first of all, if anybody's worried about earthquakes, you can calm down. We only have to deal with snowstorms because I can guarantee you the pharmaceutical companies will bury this report and nobody will ever hear about it. So we don't have to worry about earthquakes. The Newsweek, in its report on this study, reported that the president of the American Psychiatric Association noted that antipsychotic medicines now generate $6.5 billion in sales a year, a registered concern that mental disorders are being over-medicalized. He said, as a profession, we have allowed the biopsychosocial model to become the bio model. I must tell you, I spoke somewhere about panic disorders, so a lay group, and a bucha comes over to me, and I related some of the research that shows early family environmental impacts that could make it more likely for a child to later on develop panic disorders. So a bucha comes over to me, and he tells me that he's very curious about what I said because he's been suffering from panic disorders for 2 years. He's on medication, he's in therapy, and he spoke a little bit about his family, and he mentioned that when he gets an off shot, it's every 5-6 weeks, he dreads going home because one of his parents is tremendously controlling and the other one is tremendously critical. And he simply dreads going home. So I asked him, what did your therapist say to you about this? He said, we've never discussed it. He told me it's biological, I should take medication and do cognitive behavior therapy. And this is very common. I'm not saying, unusual stories. I could give you hundreds of these stories. Now, I'm sorry.
Well, the ones who are getting paid, I don't mind. You know, at least they're getting parnassa from it. But the ones who are not on the payroll, why are they saying this stuff? Yeah. Yeah. In New Jersey, and I'm saying there's no evidence of such a thing as even as BDMI. Yes, amazing. Now there's considerable empirical evidence challenging the widespread assumptions regarding the genetic biological roots of ADHD, OCD, ODD, panic disorders, postpartum depression, and homosexuality. If I had the time, we would go through it, but just for an example, since we don't have the time, let's talk about postpartum depression. I think you will all agree with me that it is an article of faith among the vast majority of mental health professionals and the lay public that postpartum depression is a hormonal disorder that's caused by pregnancy. Right? And therefore, there is little if any need for in-depth psychodynamic psychotherapy, because what would you need that for? It has nothing to do with it. Right? However, this belief is the only way you can put it is simply not scientific. In fact, just one, there's many studies on this, but of course I can't just quote all of them. So for example, it would be obvious, as much of shot, that if it was true, if it was truly hormonal, so if you would compare groups of women of childbearing age, those who gave birth and those who never gave birth during that period of time, there should be a higher incidence of depression among those who gave birth. That is not the case. There is not one study that was ever made in the history of humanity that ever brought that out. And there are many studies that are the opposite. So from this, I'll quote you a quote, just one quote from the journal Social Psychiatry and Psychiatric Epidemiology. Right? We can agree that's not a psychoanalytical journal. It says the following. Aside from anecdotal reports, we have not been able to locate credible research evidence which indicates that major depression is more frequent in women who have recently given birth. It is clear that many of the cases of depression noted in the postnatal period represent exacerbations or continuations of a pre-existing set of symptoms of depression. Okay, so somebody who already has depression, depressive issues, and is being exacerbated by the childbirth. Right, and yet, countless postpartum women are told that their depression is purely hormonal and there is no reason for them to have any psychodynamic psychotherapy. I think this is a disservice. Now, since we're working with the assumption, since the assumption is that the cause, that the emotional disorders and the emotional distress does not have a meaning, therefore, of course, the therapies don't have to have any meaning. The number one therapy that's recommended is medication. Even though the magical cures that are promised by the pharmaceutical companies in their multicolored brochures, which so clearly and vividly illustrate how the problem is a chemical imbalance, and how this magic pill is going to make it all go away, I think almost every credible clinician knows that those claims are highly exaggerated. Our very own Dr. Sholem Feinberg, who reviewed the recent American Psychiatric Association conference in Atlanta, reported in the Nefesh News the following regarding the treatment of schizophrenia. And I quote, "All of us who treat this disorder see the limitations of our present pharmacological strategy. I was struck by the increased focus at the APA conference on the value of CBT techniques for this illness." And this last statement is very important. "This emphasis on talking to our patients and working with them, their inner world, in some ways feels like back to the future." Ad kan divrei Dr. Feinberg. Right? Well, what is that? Right? So things we're going back to when we actually talk to our patients and try to find out what's going on in their inner world. Now, if you really want to know what's going on in your patient's inner world, I would recommend that psychodynamic therapy does a lot more of that than cognitive behavior therapy. And there's a great deal of compelling evidence that dynamic psychotherapy, without medication, when you have well-trained and highly motivated clinicians, not the usual poor fellow who just got out of psychology school, social work school last week, has never actually seen a patient, you throw him in with a schizophrenic patient. First patient I saw, I remember when I graduated, was a girl who cut herself all the time. What in the heck did I know about that? Poor girl. Right? Now, thank you, I appreciate that. Now, let's even talk about the studies that talk about the effectiveness of CBT, right? That supposedly cures anybody from anything in 16 sessions. Most of these studies that report these findings are done in research settings which have highly selective inclusion-exclusion criteria. If you actually ever read these studies and you read the criteria, Now, for instance, if you're studying CBT for anxiety, they won't let in a patient who also suffers from depression. Have you ever met a patient who suffers from anxiety who doesn't suffer from depression and vice versa? I have never met such a person. They seem to somehow find these people, right? And those people you can cure in 16 sessions. Now, what's even more interesting, and also the follow-up studies, even on their studies, the follow-up studies are not half as impressive as the original studies, and therefore they most recently now recommend... what do they call it? They don't call it gossiping long-term therapy. It's called, I forgot the name. They came up with some other cute name to say the same thing. You have to see them for much longer to prevent relapse prevention. God forbid, don't say the word long-term therapy. Okay. We talked about that. I have mental tests on the other side. Yeah, be careful what you say. Okay. Now, there was a recent survey, a very interesting survey, that they ask these very same researchers who report these 16-session cures, how about in your private practice? How about in your clinics where you don't have these exclusion criteria? How long does therapy take? You probably shouldn't be surprised. It's considerably longer than 16 sessions. That's usually not reported. Now, what's even more interesting, the recent literature of cognitive behavior therapists started talking about the importance of connecting current difficulties to early development. Right, but again, this is it's chas v'sholem not to, because that's what you need for therapy, is to prevent relapse. It's also part of relapse prevention. You talk about, you have to connect it to early life events, and of course they do not acknowledge that idea to psychodynamic psychology. I find it very ironic that many clinicians reject psychodynamic psychotherapy because they mistakenly believe that it has been disconfirmed by research. I cited, I'm going to not speak about it now, but Weston has a study, Drew Weston, showing how the contemporary research actually confirms most of the most important postulates of dynamic psychotherapy. But I find it very interesting, so people don't want to touch psychodynamic psychotherapy because that's not scientific. But any current fad, the fad of the year technique that comes along, everybody embraces in spite of the scientific evidence. For example, EMDR. EMDR is the hot thing of the year. Right? Everybody flocks to take expensive training courses. If you read the research that was not done, that is done by people who are not associated with the EMDR Institute, you will find that it's on very shaky scientific ground. Barlow, again, he's probably one of the world experts on anxiety disorders, he writes the following in his recent edition. There is evidence that the active component of EMDR is imaginal exposure, which is the standard behavioral treatment for trauma, and that the eye movements, which is the one innovative feature of EMDR, are essentially irrelevant. And you look at all the literature reviews that are written by independent researchers, refute the whole thing, but still everybody's running to do it. I therefore implore all clinicians to please study the original empirical research before telling patients that their symptoms are caused, again, not associated with, but caused by genetic malfunctions and chemical imbalances, and that CBT is the therapy of choice for everything. Okay. Again, I also do cognitive work. I think any decent therapist, the dynamic therapists are doing cognitive work before the cognitive therapists were born. You know, they just gave a new name. Somebody wrote an article about the plagiarism of the cognitive therapist who took dynamic ideas and gave them new names. Now, as I conclude with this last tidbit of information that should perhaps tell us more than all of the empirical research that I cited. John Norcross, who you probably all know, is not a psychoanalyst, reported in the November 2005 issue of the American Psychologist that only 8% of behavior therapists choose behavioral treatment for themselves. You hear? What is when a behavior therapist needs therapy? Who does he turn to? A behavior therapist? Only 8% of them do. 92% preferred psychodynamic, eclectic, and humanistic therapy. That probably tells us something. Thank you very much. 39 minutes. You owe me a minute. Talk about OCD.
When Ben Sien told me his